This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today our guest is Whitney Ferris, who is an internationally recognized executive coach, a keynote speaker, and a leadership advisor with 20 years of experience in the healthcare industry. Formerly chief of staff to the CFO at Intuitive Surgical, she led high-impact organizational health initiatives, launched global leadership development programs, and coached rising professionals into senior roles. Her multifaceted career spans sales, finance, and commercial operations, while she spearheaded the creation of a $2 billion international leading portfolio. As the founder of Whitney Ferris Coaching, she developed the Courageous Leader Roadmap, a practical approach for leaders to show up authentically, navigate adversity, and drive meaningful results. She is an ICF-accredited PCC coach, and is passionate about helping leaders elevate their influence and build high-performing teams. So, Whitney, welcome to the program. It's great to have you on today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's give a little context. I always like to kind of start with where'd you grow up and how'd you get into this corporate business world and where you are now. So just give us a little summary of how you started.
Of course. So I am from a fairly small town in Indiana. So I grew up Midwest where, you know, we love sports, family, there's not that much to do. At least there wasn't back in the 80s when I was a kid. But I would say that my passion for leadership really got started in fourth grade, just before I started fourth grade. And I went to a volleyball camp with one of my best friends. I love sports, had an older brother, was trying to find, you know, my sport. And I met a coach who just saw something in me. And I will never forget, at the end of the week long camp, he went up to my mom and he said, "Hey, you know, I think your daughter could be really good." And I kind of overheard this, but yeah, you know, she definitely is going to need some training and some development. Could I train her? I have a small group training of young players. And I remember thinking, I don't know what he sees in me, because I wasn't the best person there. But I wanted to train with someone who saw my potential and had that belief and wanted to invest in me. And honestly, so I went on to play for him for a number of years. I won 3 state championships in high school under him, a national championship in club. This guy won 21 state championships in 34 years, if you can believe that. So, but the results weren't what drew me to leadership, although I love winning for sure. It was really how he developed his players, all high achieving players. I mean, 12 out of 12 girls on my team would get D1 scholarships. And to take high performers who gravitated to play for him, knowing some of them were going to sit the bench because they were on a high performing team, and to make them a cohesive unit that loved to play together, was successful, could overcome any adversity, that made him such a special coach. And that actually is what inspired me to really be the coach in the corporate landscape for many, many years, leading teams, and then branching off and having my own coaching and advisory business. Because I just think it's such a gift to be able to be on the journey with people to strive to achieve things that really matter to them and to become the people and the leaders that they want to be.
So now I might've missed this at the beginning. What was the sport?
I played volleyball.
Volleyball. Okay, great. And did you go on to play that in college as well then?
I did. I got a scholarship to the University of Virginia and had a great 4-year career there.
That's big time. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's something I'm proud of for sure. It's not easy to do.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You know, I'm always marveled at, you know, by Division I athletes, because the sport does take so much time, but school isn't any easier. So you got to do the school and the sport and time. And I admire people that can do that. So that's awesome. So then you went into sales, right? You got a job in sales, and so the sales world is not for the faint of heart. So how do you survive in a sales-oriented world like that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you use that phrase. It's not for the faint of heart because I'm prepping for a keynote for a sales org on Thursday. And it's literally the line I say is that you and I can relate that sales is not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
How do you survive it? Well, I think first of all, you have to be the right type of person to love sales. And I really genuinely enjoyed it, but I also love the hunt of finding a customer where my products could bring value to them, and then going along that journey to help them figure out is this right for them, and then how they acquire it or get trained on it and use it, and all of those things. But I think that you always have to ask yourself, is this a job and the type of day-to-day that I really love? Because it is full of challenge, adversity, learning how to flex your communication style to different people and situations. And so every day almost brings something completely new that you think after so many years in sales and sales leadership, you would have seen it all or know how to solve every problem, but you don't. And that was one of the things that I loved about it, was the ability to constantly have challenge and newness and big goals ahead of me and figure out, okay, how am I going to do this time? How am I going to work with the people on my team to, drive towards this common goal? But I think that is one of the places where I saw people so hungry and driven to make themselves better. And it actually is what kind of prompted me to initially start coaching when I wasn't even part of my job description. I just moved out of my sales role, was simply because I had all these people reaching out to me to mentor them.
Yeah.
And, especially females who had made the transition to having families, or young professionals that wanted to know how I got to where I was. And I have such a soft spot for people that want to make themselves better. And if I could help them, I would. And I found that to be my real passion.
And that was in, you were a pharmaceutical sales rep, is that correct?
Yeah, I was in pharmaceutical sales, and then I had this huge career break. I was in pharma for 2 years, and a
Okay.
huge career opportunity to go to a company called Lumenis. And I was selling aesthetic lasers. It's a very different business than pharma.
Yeah.
But I was at a point where I thought, I've gotten 2 years of experience. Let me just see what's out there. If not, I have a great career path here. And I went into selling capital equipment. And in that industry, it's not as regulated as like a standard medical device. And so it was a completely different sales environment, competitive landscape from a selling perspective. And I got to tell you, it almost broke me. I mean, it's one of the moments in my career I go back to. And I 6 weeks into this job with, back then it was a bunch of different organizations. So there wasn't sales training. Your leader just took you under their wing and taught you. Well, my leader got promoted a week into my job.
No
So that
way.
he was now the VP of sales. I moved from Florida, where my first job was, across the country to Los Angeles. There were so many new things, and I had always gotten through the times where I was maybe underqualified by outworking people. And I got to the point that outworking wasn't the answer to being successful in that role. I had to grow. I had to take a different approach. And about 6, 8 weeks into the job, I realized what I did in my last role wasn't going to make me successful. And I truly contemplated resigning. Like, I wasn't ready for this. It was a massive jump in scope of selling and experience, and I didn't have it. But again, kind of like that first coach that I had, this leader thought I had a lot of potential. And so I ended up going to him and saying, "Hey, I'm realizing I'm not going to deliver the results that you expect, nor I expect. Can I get more of your time? I know you just took on this big role, but could I get an hour a week?" And he lived about 20 minutes from me. We'd meet at his home office, and we would just whiteboard out my deals, and I would learn through his real-time coaching. And I turned it around. I mean, I ended up that year being Rookie of the Year. That
Right.
experience was one where I think it underscores something I so fundamentally believe, which is so often the hardest times in our lives, personal and professional, are what shape us in so many great ways. And so there's always that silver lining and adversity, and that was a big one for me.
Well, there's a great lesson I heard in that story is that you had the guts, I guess, to ask for help. And so many times as you're building your career and working up the ladder and so on, I think people are afraid to do that. It's afraid that it's going to look weak or like I need help or whatever. Yet, we all know that we get to where we get because of people that help us get there. So asking for help is a good thing to do.
Yeah, it's not always easy. There's always the risk that someone's going to judge you. Like, well, I hired you, you should know this.
Right.
But I could tell you, if I was honest, I knew the path that I was going. It wasn't going to lead me to success. So what did I have to lose? And that leader is still someone that I communicate with today, because I just remember standing on the stage winning that award, and I thought to myself, he truly changed my professional life. Through his investment in me. And so that was just a super, it, that was more meaningful to have someone who shaped me in that way than the award ever was.
Yeah, for sure. So did you go right from sales then into your starting your coaching business, or was there a executive level position in between?
I have such a unique career, in the sense that I went from sales, in pharma and capital equipment to a company called Intuitive. I got recruited over there. I was actually really happy in my job at Luminous. And then, one of my colleagues left and went to Intuitive and said, you've got to check this out. And so I stayed in sales, mostly as sales leadership at Intuitive for, oh, let's call it 10 years. And then I had this kind of nagging thought in my head, which was, I'm totally happy in sales, but what exists aside from sales? And I wasn't sure if I was ready to pivot or not, but I kind of got to a point where I felt like it was the right time, and there was an opportunity to leverage my sales skills to launch essentially a leasing company within our med device organization. So myself and I had no leasing experience, but I had the sales experience and the executive selling experience. Myself and a VP from a leasing company came together, and we launched this function. And we essentially funded our transactions with our own balance sheet. But we had to create everything. We had to make it work internally. We had to get the sales force on board to let us into their deals. It was really an idea that we had no idea if it would actually work. And so they said, hey, you've got 18 months, maybe 24 to prove out this concept. And if it doesn't work, then we'll roll you back into the sales force or another job. And I did that for 6 years. We ended up building it to a global team where we were offering leasing all over Asia, Europe, the US. It became, one of our top ways that our customers acquire technology was through these solutions. Had a huge impact on our customers being able to afford our systems sooner to treat their patients. And that's when I started coaching at Intuitive. I launched internal coaching because I had all these people coming to me really wanting to learn from me and pick my brain on different things in their business. And so I went, got certified, I started coaching, and I just offered that, on the side. It was not part of my job description. And through doing that work and showing results, the CFO came to me one day and said, we've got a bunch of leadership and org health challenges, areas we want to grow in. Will you come start up another function? And so I was chief of staff to the CFO. I also led an org health function, providing leadership development, talent pipeline programs, coaching, to the organization. And that was when I said, when I leave this company, because it was my favorite place I'd ever worked. I truly loved the company. It was my favorite job, but I always wanted to start my own company. And
Yeah.
after 17 years at Intuitive, I made the jump about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, that was kind of my next question was going to be, wow, you created this perfect job. You sound very happy about it. I'm sure you're making great money. Why leave? People hearing that would say, wow, you've got it. Why would you leave and take the risk of doing something on your own where you kind of start over?
Yeah. And all of those perceptions would be correct. There were many people that said, why are you doing this? I had this idea back in 2017, so long before I left, where I thought at a certain point in my career, I want to do all of the things that I just love to do. And the truth be told, I loved my job at Intuitive. I loved my boss. I loved my colleagues. But when you get to a certain level, less and less of your time is spent doing the things that you really love, right? You have people that are doing all the things that you love, and you're managing the team. And I don't say that like I was unhappy, but I just saw this vision of having a greater impact and spending more of my time doing the things that I truly loved. And it was an idea that I had that grew and grew and grew as I got more corporate experience. And I just kind of felt like it was the right time. And truthfully, my kids were kind of at the age where most people are like, oh, my kids don't need me anymore. I'm good. You know, my kids were, let's call it when I made the jump, like 8 and 10. And I was traveling all the time. And I thought to myself, you know, I think now is right. I can be around more, still have a career that I love, and go build this business. So it's really firing on all cylinders in the next few years. And the timing just felt right for me.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about leadership stuff now, since that's what you're focusing on and coaching others. I read somewhere else in hearing you talk where you said you need to define your leadership identity. So tell me what that means to you, and how do you help people get there?
Yeah. So defining your leadership identity, I think, is something that is so overlooked. It's in a concept that's often talked about. And what that means is essentially creating a set of core principles as to that define how you will lead and who you will be as a leader. So I explain it to people this way. You know, we live our life every single day with a set of core values. Imagine going through your morning from the time you wake up to lunchtime and not being guided by core values. I don't care what they are. Like, I just imagine myself to get my kids out the door, to get them dropped off at school, carpool line, traffic. If I wasn't committed to a certain set of values, I'd be like honking my horn and yelling at people, you know? But there are things that tell me this is who I want to be. This is an example that I want to set. This is what's important to me. This is bigger than how I feel in the moment. And that guides me. And I think we step into leadership. And we just think we're going to just be who we've always been, which is not necessarily wrong, but there's a level of intentionality that exceptional leaders have. And it doesn't just come by chance. It is something that they are making decisions on how they want to be perceived as a leader, what their approach is to leadership, how they're going to show up in the tough moments, so that in all those day-to-day interactions, they are showing up as a person that they think is going to be most effective for their teams, for the business, and for themselves. And so defining your leadership identity is going through kind of a set of questions to really reflect and then to land on a set of, let's call it 6 to 8 core principles that will drive who you are as a leader. Now, the key is you have to be willing to share those. So I would share my set of leadership principles with people once I got, you know, kind of that final interview process. This is who I am as a leader. This is what you can expect from me. I would share them with my team. I would share them with my leader. It became something that we would share as a leadership team when I was at Intuitive so that we knew who each other were committed to being. And I think it guides you when you've taken the time to really commit to those, it guides you in the moments where you could default to being reactive or to just assuming and not being curious. And I think those are the moments that matter to be a leader that truly influences and inspires.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and just thinking the world we live in right now, and we won't get into specifics on that, but building trust, you know, is tougher, I think, than maybe it used to be. And so, how do you build trust in an organization where people aren't sure what to listen to, what's true, what isn't true, what's just hype, what's real? You know, what do you do to build trust in an organization?
Yeah. So the first thing that I always focus on is just getting deep enough in the business that I can really understand it, which means if I like, let's take the example of a lot of times where you need trust the most is when you're collaborating across functions or you're working with a team that isn't yours. And you know, you don't have all the day-to-day interactions and you haven't had multiple touch points with all those people to know them and to earn that trust. So the first thing I like to do is really understand their business. What are their goals? What are their challenges? How is it that our functions are gonna, you know, work together? And this can just be done through casual conversation and really, showing that you care about knowing them and their team and their business, right? And I think when you seek to understand all of that, then you can figure out where can I bring value and where there may be some tension points that I'm going to need to navigate delicately as I work with these teams or these people over time. And then my focus is on I have to make sure to establish trust. I'm truly listening. I'm bringing value, and I am accountable to the person that I commit to being with them. Which means if I say like, "Hey, we're in this together. We're going to make this decision together because it affects both of our teams." I don't then go to my boss and say, "I think we should do this, but this person's not on board." I have that tough conversation with that person. We work that out, and we come to a place of consensus or alignment, and we move through that together. I think it's building trust. It does take time, so you might not be able to do all of that before you have your first set of interactions, but it has to be something that is of high focus for you so that you are building trust over time and you don't just realize one day, oh, this is not good and we have something that needs to be achieved. Where do we start?
Yeah, I think that's you said it well, because a lot of people say, oh, I've got to we've got to build trust, we've got to build trust, but you've got to be patient because it takes time, and by doing things over a long period of time consistently and so on, that's how you get there. So I think it is interesting when people want it, but you have to be willing to let it develop over time too.
Yeah, I mean, how do you build trust with somebody that you don't know? I mean, it doesn't mean that you have to know everything about them or their teams, but you can't just if you go in and assume, you're going to make it harder to build trust. You have to invest in that person or that group to be able to show that you're trustworthy.
Yeah. I've also heard you say that you need to activate a power zone. So tell us, what's a power zone?
So your power zone is where you're operating at your best, where you can thrive. And the concept to me came from back in my days as a D1 athlete. I realized even when I was maybe in high school, and you're performing under pressure, that you can't just step onto the court and just think you're going to show up. So for me, I realized there was a routine that I needed to lean on to make sure that I had cleared my head, I was focused, I was in the right mindset, I was ready to, handle whatever happened in that match. And then as I went into business, I quickly found that was equally as important. When I was going to high stakes meetings, when I was handling conflict, when I was dealing with difficult personalities where maybe we just operated in very different ways, right? And so I started learning through leading people. People think that, when an athlete, they say, oh, they went beast mode or they were in their zone. It's like we look at them like it happens by chance. I don't think it does. I think it's a choice. I think
Yeah.
it's a choice. And it is a choice that there's a set of things that typically can get us anchored into our power zone. And in moments where we are starting to deviate from it, we can activate certain things to get back into it, or we can mentally make the shift. Hey, like this is not the moment to like dwell on all the frustrations. I got to be in this meeting. I got to move past this momentarily and get in the game, be in the meeting, and then deal with all the other stuff after the fact. And so I take people through a process of really understanding their activators and their depleters. And through that, you can start defining what your power zone looks like over time, right? Because it's a process of reflecting and trying things and understanding. And then once you know what it feels like and what it looks like and what puts you there, then you become hyper aware of what takes you out of it, the people, the environments, just your ways of what's happening in your own personal world. And you can start getting ahead of that to set yourself up for success in your routines, in your mindset, in those different ways.
And when you're under pressure, focusing on things that you can control and not wasting a lot of brain energy and time on things that are just totally out of your control.
Yeah, I mean, people always say, well, yeah, I started my power zone and then I go into a meeting and the way the meeting takes a turn or someone how they communicate with me in the meeting, it takes me out of my power zone. And then what? It's like, you got about 3 seconds to get back into it. It's a practice, it's a habit. So, is it perfect? No, of course it's not perfect. But it is something that with my clients, I have been able to help them understand. I'm very aware that this is, this conversation, this person is pulling me back. They're pulling me under, and I here are the things I can do in that moment to regroup as a professional or as a person and get back to where I am at my best in that meeting. Because we have to own that we are accountable for whatever outcomes we produce. And that ownership, once you have that ownership mindset, it helps you really sort through, okay, so if I only have, 30 seconds after some sort of tense interaction in a meeting, what do I do so that I don't show up that way the next 30 minutes of that meeting, but I can actually bring value and represent myself and my team well?
I love how you say that. Own your behavior, own your performance. It's easy to say blame somebody or someone else's fault or whatever, but realizing that no matter what experience you had in that interaction, there is something that you affected, positive, negatively, or neutral, but you still did, and so you need to own that and understand that.
It's so interesting. I think a lot of people go into leadership, and I want to say I personally think leadership is a capability. I think you can be a leader and not necessarily have a team. And that means having a broader scope of influence and going kind of above and beyond what your job looks like and your ability to influence and drive results and affect people. But when I talk about people leadership, a lot of people go into people leadership and I think they believe I was super successful just doing what I did as an individual contributor. And so I'm just going to go do that. And people often don't understand in people leadership, you're working through others. And what comes along with that is great leaders, when their team is under fire, they stand right in front of them. They are the ones taking the heat, being accountable, because guess what? You are leading that team. You are the ultimate decision maker. You can't control people's actions, but your job is to set them up for success. And when they are off track, to figure out how you get them to the place that they need to be. But you own that. And when your team is shining and getting all the results, you're standing in the back. They're getting the spotlight, not you. And so I think really great leaders, that they truly believe that at their core. And that's the difference to me and someone who manages a team or manages a business versus is truly an inspirational leader. And when you are an inspirational leader, that goes beyond your team. You're influencing across, up at all levels in organizations. And those are the people that are really game changers for companies. And where I really believe there's a lot of opportunity to build people from that manager to manager of the business and the people to really leading and inspiring.
Well said. I'm sure that it's more than what we can just cover in this podcast, but you have created what's called the excellent equation. There's eight steps. So could you just summarize for us what that is and why you use that?
Yeah, so definitely more than I won't, overload you with all the information, but I am a huge believer that people stop short on goals because of the uncertainty that comes along with them. Will I succeed? I don't know how to get there. Should I really be chasing this? And that mixed with a lot of the mindset challenges when you're chasing really big goals. I think causes people to fall short of their potential. And to me, I wanted to create a reproducible process that would allow people to work through the eight steps of the excellence equation to be able to approach and tackle really big goals. And not just a goal, to hit a quota or, to get the next job, but to really challenge themselves to do bigger things. And so these eight steps take you really from being anchored in why this matters to you, to assessing your readiness, to the power of choice and the role that that plays, and you actually having a shot at accomplishing that goal, all the way through the execution and navigating adversity to make it happen. And so it's really a mixture of a step-by-step process to for people to lean on as they march towards the things that they really want to chase in their career, along with some of the mindset work, like overcoming adversity. And there's a sliver that's similar to activating your power zone so that you are in the space where you can really thrive.
As a coach, how do you know, we use words like executive presence and authentic leadership, and those are commonly used, and I think we understand what those mean. But how do you, as a coach, get people to live that?
Well, that's a good question. Part of defining your leadership identity is to help them really be clear on who they are authentically. And I will say one of the beautiful things about defining your leadership identity is it's a mix of who you are and also accountability and who you want to be. And so defining your leadership identity actually came from taking people through this process of really being clear on who they are authentically and how they want to lead, because they were having these moments where they show up in ways that are ineffective, that they look back on and go, I should have done that differently. And so how do we have a process to not have that continue to happen? And so I think it's helping them get clear on who they are around authenticity or how they're doing with executive presence, so that they have a bit of a benchmark, and then they can measure against that as they go through their day to day. On executive presence, that is, I would say, the number one topic people want help on. I get so many people that say, to get to the next level as a VP or SVP, I have to work on my executive presence. And that topic, I love it and I dislike it at the same time, because that is such a huge topic. And when we talk about what is executive presence, it's like, three categories that each have four things in them. So the first thing I ask people is, give me an example of where your executive presence falls short, or tell me what specifically within the scope of executive presence is your opportunity for growth. And most of the time, they don't know. And
It's not
so
a thing. Yeah, it's not a thing. It's
it's not a thing, right? And so for me, a big part of this work is really getting clear on what the gap is for them and getting them clear on that. And then we can work to close that gap, whether it's authenticity or executive presence or whatever it is. But the way I see it as a coach is, if we define current state and we d then we can define that their desired future state, it's all just about closing that gap. And how I do that with each client is going to be a little bit different, because they need different things, they have a different set of experiences, they have different personalities. And their end goals aren't always the same. And so it's a little bit of a puzzle, which makes it fun to figure out how I can help them get there, because they're really doing the work.
And hearing your story, like we talked about earlier, you're a Division One athlete and you still got to go to school. So that's something that you need to balance. You had a very tough career in a sense where you're on the road all the time and you've got a lot of high pressure and there's a lot of benchmarks you have to meet. You have two young kids. So you might be the perfect person to say, how do you balance all that? And how do you help clients look at that and try and say, how can I achieve what I want to professionally, but still have these other balances that need consideration?
Well, the short answer is you don't. If we were talking candidly, it's I always tell people, the balance of it is something you have to constantly manage. But I will tell you a couple common themes that have helped me along the way. The first one is, you have to do something that you're passionate about. And I don't like I have not loved every job. I certainly have not loved every leader that I've worked for. There are even jobs I'm like, oh, why did I want to take this? But there are elements that I love, I that make me want to get up and do the job every day. If not, I know it's going to be a short timeline and I'm going to figure out what my next move is. But I think when you're doing work that you enjoy, it makes it easier to make the trade-offs. There are times where, as a young mom, first of all, you have to have a support system. My husband works too. He's a vice president at a tech company. But you have to have alignment in a support system. Who does what? Because that way things aren't constantly in chaos. So I find things I'm passionate about. I get a clear support system with alignment with those people in my life. It's not just one person, it's lots. And then it's about constantly checking in on how am I doing in the parts of my life that matter. My kids, you know, my husband, my job, my team, you know, how am I doing? And the truth is, at all times, most of the time, I should say, 85% of the time, one of them is getting more than the other. There are times where I'm on the road more than I like to be, and that's hard for me as a mom. But there are other times where, you know, my family gets a little bit more of me than the job. And I think you have to be really anchored that you want to be doing all of these things. Otherwise, it feels like you're suffering. You know, when you're in a situation you don't like, you feel like this is just killing me day by day. When you're doing something that has a purpose that matters to you, a boss that you love, a team that you love, it makes it a lot easier. So finding that passion, creating that support system, and constantly checking in. You cannot expect that there's a destination here. I mean, it's not like to me, it's like week by week. My husband and I are like, okay, what's happening this week? I was super stressed this week. I was pulled, you know, this direction with taking the kids to their practices after work. Can you do this? And you have to embrace the chaos. Otherwise, it can definitely eat you alive. The other thing I'll say, you didn't ask about this, but I think it's important, is we all have a level of guilt about things that we're doing and not doing. You know, for a lot of women, they struggle with, you know, should I be the mom that's at every class party? Did I bake the cookies? Should I be around more? Some of my friends, you know, they're around more than me. You know, I think men actually struggle with that too. I just don't think they talk about it as much. Or
Good point.
women, there's this perception like, well, we should be there more. And you have to let go of that guilt. You have to work through that guilt. For me, I will be very candid that one of the things that kept me hanging on to the guilt for a long time was just comments made by people, you know, around me, friends, family members that all meant well, but would say things like, I'm just so sorry you have to travel so much. It's just so hard on you and the kids. Or, oh, wow, you travel? How do you balance that? You know, or you show up at work and someone's like, who takes care of your kids when you're on the road? I'm like, I don't like leave them at home. You know, they have a dad and grandparents and things like, but those comments for so long in the back of my mind made me feel guilty that I wanted to do a job that had an impact and made me happy. And I got to the point, and it took me far too long to realize just because I have children in a family, I still deserve happiness too. And I can do both. And what works for me may look different than you. But that's what works for you. And I'm going to be okay with me. And the sooner you can wrap your mind around that, it's not necessarily a pretty process. The sooner that you can do that, the more freeing it is. And the less that work-life balance feels like a pull. Does that make sense?
Totally. And a lot of things came out of that when I heard you talk. And for me, I hate labels. You know, when people try and label you, they make a comment and it has a judgment on the back end of it. Like the thing I hate is when people say, oh, you're so busy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that to me, that's a judgment statement. You know, somebody's judging that. And you know, I should be as busy as I need to be for what I'm trying to accomplish and what my comfort zone is. The other thing that came to mind too, and I've said this on this program before, there is a great leadership book that not many people know about, but it's called Yes to the Mess. And basically what this author is saying is that you can't have an unrealistic expectation that everything will be smooth and everything's in balance. As you said,
Right.
it's not. So it's more of managing that and making sure that sometimes I'd out of balance over here and sometimes I'd out of balance over here, but you just need to manage it. But you can't expect it to be in perfect balance all the time because that is unrealistic.
Yeah, and I think where the corporate space is, it's a struggle right now because I will tell you, this is my experience, and I've talked to clients about this too. They're seeing it too, where the younger generation of professionals have a very different expectation for what work means in their lives and what balance looks like, and it's just there's this different perspective. And that's not everybody, but I mean, I've got quite a bit of data points on this and some of the programs I've led and working with clients on the same issue. And so we've all got to give a little bit, you know, if we're expecting that we're all remote and we work when we want to work, we have ultimate flexibility and unlimited PTO, You might not make the money that someone who's willing to work 60 hours a week and be at the office every day is gonna make. Or you might not be eligible for that promotion. At the same time, I think as organizations, we can't say this is the way we've always done it, so we're gonna keep doing it. We have to really evaluate what do our people need to do their jobs well? What does the business need? And there's no one size fits all answer. So this whole debate of like remote work or this or that, I'm like, there's no one answer. And what works for some companies and some jobs, even at the same company, is not going to work for others. But I see this as a major tension point as we think about work-life balance and what companies expect and what people want for it.
And I, with my clients, I often challenge them and say, okay, maybe the way to look at this is because I know you're a lifelong learner and believe in that, as do I. So what can I learn from that? What can I learn from that perspective that is different than mine? Instead of fighting it and saying, you know, you're slacking and you're not doing this, it should be different. What can I learn from their approach that maybe can help me too? So, you know, I think we have to be open to that.
It's a great point.
Yeah. So what about I noticed I heard you say the other day intergame leadership. So is that the Tim Galloway intergame thing that you're talking, do you know what I'm talking about with that the book?
I don't.
Okay. Well, there was a guy that it's an older book and it's been around long, but he wrote several of them called the Intergame Approach, and that was more like what you need to do as opposed to try and analytically think about everything. Like an athlete, you need to get that muscle memory. You need to get what does it feel like and when does it feel good, and it feels good. So what did I do to get there? And it's more of a almost a feel thing than analytical push, push, hack, hack. You know, it's more like you develop it over time. So I heard you say intergame. So I was just wondering if you were a proponent of that that book.
I have not read that one. I will say, so I have a philosophy on leadership that at a certain point, well, I'm going to take you back to what I think the evolution of people leadership is, right? The evolution from we have a job, we're responsible for ourselves and our outcomes. We now step into leading a team. We typically start by managing the business. We're just trying to make sure we hit the KPIs, we got the people on the team, they're fairly happy. Then we kind of move to more managing the people. And by managing the people, we're developing them. We're driving better business results because we're focused on the people and the metrics. And we can pull the levers to make the two work. And then we start to step into really truly being a leader that leads, influences, inspires, drive results beyond their team, is someone that people are looking to for guidance as an example. And I think the most exceptional leaders, they inspire, they compel, they influence. It's people want to follow, and people are gravitating towards them. To really be that upper echelon, those kind of top two tiers of inspirational leadership and beyond, it's not about what you know. It actually is about who you are. And I think that is one of the biggest misses, is that we as leaders are like, I'm going to read this book and I'm going to go to this course. Like, and believe me, I read all the books. And I run corporate development programs. I teach all the stuff. But when I have followed people that I've either coached or have been in my leadership development programs, the ones that truly excel, that they grow leaps and bounds, they're driving more significant results, are the ones that don't just develop the skills, but they are developing themselves so that they can more effectively utilize the skills. They are being intentional about their leadership identity, about how they navigate adversity, about how they connect with their teams. And they are developing themselves as a person that people want to follow. And so I really, really believe around leadership that we have to at some point develop ourselves along with all the skills and the strategies and the tactics that we have in our toolkit.
Absolutely. I think that we all know people that, like you said, read the books, listen to the podcasts, can regurgitate all the one-liners and the theories and whatever, but until you implement them and institute them into you so that it doesn't come across as just something that you're saying, it's again, I would go back to more it's what you feel and how you portray that is what really makes you a good leader. Now you have a jumping on that, you have a young daughter, right?
Yes.
So, what do you want her to learn, or what are you teaching her at this stage, you know, to be a great female leader in the future? What have you learned through your career, and what do you want her to know?
Yeah, I love that question. Well, I will tell you, one of the things that we work on a lot is imposter syndrome and managing that inner narrative. And I don't care what role you have, what job you do, it is there. It's another one of those things that I think women talk about a lot. And well, I don't want to say it was surprising to me, but when I entered my coaching business, men struggle with it just as much. It's just not as openly discussed. I think it kind of comes up when women are in like a women's business development group or whatever it is. But with my daughter, I will never forget, she was 8. And she said to me one day, and it honestly, it almost brought me to tears. We were both reading next to each other before she goes to bed. And she said, "Hey, mom, do you ever like have this voice in your head?" And so I was like, I better ask some questions around this because this could go a lot of directions. I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" And she was like, "Well, sometimes when I raise my hand at school, I'll think, why did I say that? That was kind of a silly comment." Or sometimes when I have an interaction with a friend, I'm thinking, "Oh, was that the right thing to do? Was that the wrong thing to do? I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. And I was like, all the time. I mean, multiple times a day. And what took me back by it was that I really work on instilling belief and confidence in my children. Like I am just actively a proponent of you have to generate your own belief. No one needs to believe in you but you at the end of the day. Because someone's always going to be sitting there thinking, you can't do it. You're not ready. You're too young. You don't have this skill. All that matters is that you believe in yourself and talking about confidence and the importance of that. And so to me, I thought, I've been preaching this since she was like, before she could understand. How is she having this inner narrative that is negative? And the fact that she heard it, I was so glad she brought it to me. And so we talk a lot about that because I think as kids grow up, and we all know this because we've been there and now we're adults, it doesn't ever go away. It's something that you have to manage. And to manage it, you have to be able to know when, like I always tell her, sometimes that voice in your head, it tells you lies, just straight lies. And so you have to be able to decipher and ask yourself a couple questions to know, should I worry about this? Should I stress out? Is this really true? Or is this just me kind of being a little bit worried? And I think that's a big one. The other things we talk about is just having the confidence to make your own decisions. She's almost 11, so she's getting more influence in the world, friends, and she has friends that have phones, although she doesn't. And just it's hard to do the unpopular thing. And so I think as leaders, gosh, I mean, how many times do we have to do the thing that we don't want to do, give hard feedback, fire an employee, raise your hand in a meeting with a bunch of our peers and our boss and say, actually, I don't agree with that. And I feel like starting to build that skill young, I hope, gosh, I hope will serve her as she grows up and does whatever she's going to do in life.
That's a great answer. I think back to like my dad would he was very he would teach us, to be humble. Yet you need that confidence. So how do you have that confidence without coming across arrogant? And then on the other hand, I had a mentor once tell me that being overly humbled is worse than being arrogant. So again, we got to find how do we do that, and those are just things that again, you can't just say do this. You have to experience things, learn from things, reflect on things, and then you get there. But it's not easy.
And you know what? We all have the trial and error where we're too humble or we're maybe a smidge arrogant because we're trying to fit in and show that we belong. And
Right.
it's all a learning experience.
Now, is she following your footsteps in volleyball? Is she a player?
She is. She is. I will say travel sports. We need a whole nother podcast to talk about the intensity that those have become. So I won't get started on that, but yes, she plays volleyball and she does love it.
That's great. So, Whitney, in anticipation of our discussion today, what haven't I asked you or what haven't we covered that you want to make sure you get in the program?
Yeah, gosh, that's a good question. I would say adversity is something that shared some of my stories with you about adversity has been one of the greatest gifts in my growth journey. And one of the things that I always tell people is that have a process to effectively navigate adversity. For me, when I'm working with my clients, I take them through this thing called the adversity reframe. And essentially what it does is it gives you a couple steps to follow. One is every time you hit adversity, the first thing you have to do is recognize the emotion. And then I just want you to park it to the side just for a little bit. So that the emotion, it's not bad. It's only bad if it causes us to behave or think in a way that is not productive. But if we can separate out that emotion when we're experiencing adversity, then we can actually get very clear on what's the problem we're solving, what's the real impact of this problem, because sometimes a problem feels really big and then we zoom out and we're like, this isn't that big of a deal. It just feels really big because maybe we cared a lot about it, or we had a vision for how it was going to go. And then what are our options for our ways forward? And so then when you start to move along your path forward, you can go back and process that emotion more effectively. But I tell people, if you can get good at managing adversity in your little stuff day to day to the big things, you are going to feel better. You're going to be more productive. And the biggest thing about adversity is I always tell people, you got to look back. It may not be the same day. It may be months or years later, and look back and find the silver lining. Because even the hardest things that I have experienced, I have grown, I have developed a new skill. I may not look back and go, I want to live that over again. That's definitely not the case, but I have become better from it. And if you really can truly believe that in adversity lies opportunity, then it makes facing it just a bit easier.
The line I used with my kids along that same lines was, everything's worth going through as long as you learn something from it.
I
As bad
agree.
as it can be, as frightening as it can be, as horrible as it can be, what did I learn? Can I learn something from that? Then going through the experience was worth the pain, I guess, is what you could say.
Yeah, what did my mom used to always say? There's never a problem that doesn't have a solution. There's always a solution. So you may not know it, but somebody does. So don't suffer in silence. Just, reach out, get help, because every single bit of adversity, there's always a way forward. You just have to look sometimes harder than others.
So at this point in the interview, I always ask my guests the same common question. And that question is, in relation to leadership, what is a pearl of wisdom that you could leave us with today?
Yeah, I would say every single quarter, look yourself in the mirror and say, am I a leader that I would want to work for? And be honest. Because so often I think we go about our day to day and we confuse effort or intention with how we're actually showing up or how we're leading. And we're human. Like, that's okay. There's no point at which I feel like as a leader, you're going to go, I've done it all. I'm great. I don't need to worry. I'm on autopilot. I mean, if someone has figured that out, please reach out to me. I want to learn from you.
Yeah.
But the only way to get better is to face the reality. And it's not fun, because we want to be like, yeah, well, I said that to that person that way because they should have known, and that there's just no room for that. So when I look at those situations, I look myself in the mirror and I go, it's a feeling you get. It's a feeling you get around, I need to be better at this, or like, how do I do this a little differently? Then I ask myself, what did I contribute to that? Like, what can I control to make it better? And I think if you're constantly asking yourself that question, and there are some quarters you're going to be like, I crushed it. I'm really proud of myself. I'm not going to dwell on the little things, but I'm guessing the next quarter you're going to have something you're going to go, if I'm honest, I probably should, work on that. So, constantly reflect and own who you are, and that's how you get to be the person that you want to be.
That's a great answer. I love it because it's so sometimes as leaders, we think, oh, I have to be this way in this situation because this is what's required. But then if you ask yourself just what you challenge us to ask ourselves, it'd be like, yeah, but I don't think that feels right. Or I wouldn't want to be talked to that way, or I wouldn't want to be handled that way. So maybe there's a different way. Great
Oh,
answer.
believe me, I've lived that, and I've been the person that's like, I'm gonna do it like my boss does it because he's super successful and I don't know any other way. And then you look back and you're like, that wasn't good. But those are the moments that drive you to become the person that you want to be. So those failures, like, you have to have them. Like, I just don't believe you're gonna get to where you want to be as a leader if you haven't failed a number of times. And they don't have to be massive public failures, but the moments where you look yourself in the mirror and you go, that I didn't handle that right. And that's okay. Make it right.
Well, Whitney, this has been just a great pleasure. If people want to contact you about potential coaching relationship or whatever, how do they do that?
Yes, please go to my website. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes, whitneyferris.com. And you can book a strategy call with me. And please follow me on social media. You can find me on LinkedIn or at Whitney underscore Ferris on Instagram. And I'd love to interact with your audience.
And your name is Ferris, but it's spelled a little differently than you might think. So spell your last name so we know.
Yeah, it's Fairess. I've tried to convince my husband it should be said Fairs because it's how most people say it. But he's not going for the pronunciation switch, so we'll just stick with it.
Okay, great. Well, again, Whitney, thanks for your being on the show today. You're a breath of fresh air. I think you're doing great things, and I love hearing your stories. So thanks for sharing that with us, and we're going to learn a lot from it. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orangethword.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.